I will be dealing in this lecture with what I call common campus curses. Questions asked by the pseudo-intellectuals, problems generated by the antagonistic professor, and generally the things which bug Christians who are trying to do an effective job of evangelizing for Christ. Now, there are three types of apologetics. There is the high-level apologetic that almost nobody pays any serious attention to on the level of the layman simply because they don't understand the vocabulary. Then there is pop apologetics, where you try and take the serious material and bring it down to the average person's level so they will know what's going on and how they can give an answer. And then there's slop apologetics. That's the person who doesn't pay any attention to what's said but grabs a snatch of this and a snatch of that and runs in and thinks they have all the answers and gets creamed. We want to avoid slop apologetics, and we're not going to go into the serious upper strata because I don't think we're going to communicate. Donald Barnhouse used to say, get the hay down out of the loft onto the barn floor where the cows can get at it. And that's really the task of the church, to feed and to build up the body of Christ. So what we're going to do is discuss some of the things that most currently and consistently bug Christians. These are the topics I hope to be able to get through. The problem of miracles. Wish fulfillment, which is God exists because I wish him to. Infinite regression. Supposing there is such a thing as cause and effect. You keep going back and back and back and back and back and you arrive at God and you keep right on going. Because after all, if you're going to regress to God, who made God? And then the universe and the existence of God. How do we know that there really is any evidence that there is such a thing as a divine mind? And can we adduce such evidence? And how would we set it forth reasonably? And then the riddle of relativism. The people who are always saying, well, it really doesn't make any difference what religion you belong to or what ethical or moral commitment you have. The only important thing is that you understand that all culture makes religion relative. So that what's true for us is not true for the Aborigine. What's true for the Aborigine isn't true for the Zulu. What isn't true for the Zulu might be true for the Amazon Indian. So culture determines the relevancy of religious values. Let's not get hung up on absolutes. There are no such things as real absolutes or eternal verities. And then the circular reasoning argument that you Christians are always talking about the Bible as the Word of God, and then to prove it, you quote the Bible to substantiate itself. That circular reasoning, why don't you get off that and try and find a better argument? These are some of the things I'd like to cover. And then we'll have a question and answer period at the end, hopefully. So if anything germinates in your fertile minds, you will have an opportunity to ask a few questions at that time. The Lord willing, and my vocal cords still remaining. Let's deal with the problem of miracles, because this is something which bugs an awful lot of people. For some good reading on the subject, I recommend C.S. Lewis's book on miracles, which does a nice job of good pop apologetics in explaining the subject. And there are also some other books that have been written on the subject, which are meaningful. InterVarsity Fellowship has put out some good stuff on miracles. And there are also some good popular treatments that are pretty well available in campus bookstores. But let's get down to the nitty-gritty of the problem of miracles. The big bugaboo in the problem of miracles is a philosopher named David Hume. And every time that you go into a university campus or take a course in philosophy, eventually you're going to run into David Hume, one of the British empiricists. Now, Dr. Hume set up a canon of evidences against the idea of miracles. And his basic argument was this: a miracle is said to be an intervention into natural law, or a reversal of natural law by a divine being, ergo, God. But as we examine the phenomena of the world, we notice that there is an uninterrupted chain of phenomena without this so-called supernatural disruption. All of our experience tells us, for instance, that corpses once thoroughly dead are not resuscitated. that water will not support the weight of a human body. All of our experience tells us that you cannot feed 5,000 or 4,000 people with a minimal amount of bread and fishes, and that the miracles so-called in the Bible do not fit into the experience that man is capable of recording, that we can see and examine. So since we have no recapitulation of that, since we have no evidence that this happens to us, we are living in a closed system. And this natural order, to all intents and purposes, is not disrupted. Since a miracle is the disruption of the natural order, there are no miracles. And then Hume went on to give evidences further beyond this particular idea as to why he didn't believe it was possible. Now, there are two quick refutations of Dr. Hume that will save you reading a lot of material. I suggest that you think about them. If you're recording them, you don't have a problem. But if you're trying to write them down, then write them carefully, because they must be stated accurately. First of all, Hume's argument rests upon a simple logical fallacy. He never, ever refuted miracles. He never, ever proved that they couldn't happen. All he did was to define them out of existence. Defining something out of existence is not the same as proving that it didn't happen. And here's how he did it. He began with the premise, we live in a closed, ordered structure. Natural law does not alter. A miracle is a break in natural law, therefore there can be no miracles. He didn't refute a miracle. He simply said, because natural law exists, there can be no miracle. So he defined them out of existence. Now, how do you really refute Hume? Simply. You do it scientifically, first of all. In 1926, Heisenberg enunciated the principle of uncertainty in the nucleus of the atom. What does that mean? It means, well, this is very impressive when you tell it scientifically. It means that at no given moment in the nuclei of an atom is it possible to account for the presence of a given electron. This is Heisenberg's principle of uncertainty. In the basic structure of atomic matter as we understand it, atomic materials as we understand it, it is impossible to determine the position of a given electron. Heisenberg therefore concluded, since the atom is the basic structure of all creation, we do not live in a closed system, we live in an open system. And a miracle could happen by Heisenberg's principle, because at any time, the system could alter. Hume's idea that we live in a closed system that never changes is scientifically refuted in 1926. The scientists have done us a great honor. They have demonstrated that Dr. Hume's argument is not scientifically valid anymore. If the basic stuff of the universe can change and is uncertain in its principles of operation, so are the so-called immutable laws of nature. They can change too. Now you have a good scientific principle to use to demonstrate that a miracle is possible on the principle of uncertainty. And it's a good scientific thing to quote. Makes sense. Also, please point out that Dr. Hume did not refute miracles. He simply defined them out of existence. And you don't refute by definitions. You simply have to come up with evidence. He had no evidence whatsoever. Now, I think that there are other things that could be quoted on the subject of the miraculous, and we could go into great detail demonstrating them. But David Hume is the fountainhead of about 80% of all criticism of miracles. And if you read his writings, he's always hammering away on those points. So hammer back on the same two points. And it really shakes people up to find out that Hume's position is really not as solid as they thought it was. Now, Hume also had some other positions on cause and effect, and he had some positions beyond that in other areas, which we don't have time to go into in depth. I'd like to be able to. When I taught apologetics consistently in college and in seminary, I used to take a whole semester on Feuerbach, Hume, and Bertrand Russell, to show how their influence has penetrated all thinking on a pop level. Nobody understands them up here, but they've been popularized down here. Now people understand them. And we don't have time to do that right now. Keep those two things in mind on miracles, particularly. A miracle is a supernatural intervention that can take place based on Heisenberg's principle of uncertainty. And you can't get rid of miracles by simply defining them out of existence. You have to refute them by proving they cannot occur. Hume never did accomplish that. In fact, there is a quotation from David Hume that is quite stunning when you read it. He said, "In observing the phenomena of nature, one cannot be insensible to the idea of an intelligent creator." This is the man who is supposed to have been anti-God, but who said that the evidence of nature itself, inductively and logically, led one to the sensible conclusion that there was somebody who was running the show. I think that's worth noting, that Hume was not, as is openly declared, an atheist. He was a skeptic. That's somebody who doesn't know and is busily engaged in chasing his tail trying to find out. Second thing we run up against quite frequently originated with Ludwig Feuerbach, the brilliant German philosopher and theologian who utterly destroyed the philosophy of Hegel. Feuerbach came to the conclusion in a book, The Essence of Christianity, that man visualized his own wishes of God and immortality, projected them beyond his body, and then worshiped them. And that God is nothing more than your desire and my desire to survive and believe in someone or something that can guarantee that survival. I've condensed 340 pages of Feuerbach into one paragraph so we can have a Reader's Digest condensation. This is the theory of wish fulfillment. Now understand it very well. I wish to exist. I wish to be immortal. I wish for God to guarantee this. Therefore, because I wish it to be true, I project that wish and worship it. And that becomes, in effect, the explanation for the idea of God. Now, of course, he does it very elaborately and develops it chapter after chapter, and it's a devastating book. Unless you really understand Feuerbach, you can get yourself not only tripped up, but pretty badly bloodied, because he was a tremendous intellect. But, as so often happens with the philosophers, the next school of philosophers that come along take care of the problem for the Christians. They refute them. But most Christians don't know who refuted Ludwig Feuerbach. The idea of wish fulfillment, which is all over your campuses under different labels. Recognize it? That idea has been refuted by another German theologian, Eduard von Hartmann. You probably never heard of him. The name is a tongue twister. He's a real buddy of ours, so you ought to get to know Ed. Eduard von Hartmann. He is called the philosopher of pessimism. He examined Feuerbach's Essence of Christianity and then wrote his own book, the essence of which is the following statement. Professor Feuerbach's entire thesis rests upon a logical fallacy. He maintains that the desire to believe and the wish to believe is proof that there is no God. Says von Hartmann, let us demonstrate by analogy how fallacious this is. I am in bed, suffering a night of agonizing pain. I wish and desire earnestly that dawn will come. The fact that I desire the dawn to come is not proof that dawn will not come. See? Think that one through. The fact that I desire dawn to come is not to be adduced as proof that dawn will never come. Now you think for a second. This was the magnificent of the sword. He cut the whole bottom right out from under the foundation. I am wishing for immortality and for God. So I desire it earnestly, and I wish very hard for it. Feuerbach says, the fact that you are wishing for it is proof that God doesn't exist. Von Hartmann turns around and says, oh yeah? Let's take it analogically. I'm suffering a night of pain and I'm wishing for dawn so that my pain will stop. The fact that I desire the dawn to come cannot be adduced as proof that dawn won't arrive. You'd be an idiot if you believe that. And he just, right out from the underneath, Feuerbach. Feuerbach's philosophy never recovered from von Hartmann's critique. But most Christians don't even know who the two of them are, and the first one gives us lots of trouble, and the second one solves the problem. Now, I realize you're going to have to think that one through for a while. Recognize there may be a little problem and try and communicate that. But nevertheless, it's a good argument. If you want a further exposition of this argument, I suggest you get hold of C.H. McIntosh's book entitled Types of Theological Systems. Types of Theological Systems, where he discusses Feuerbach, von Hartmann, and a group of other theologians and philosophers, and shows you just how it's possible to refute some of these so-called irrefutable things. That's one of them. Thirdly, infinite regression. You start talking about God and you say, well, we've got to begin someplace. So someone or something must have made us, because we're finite. So let's regress back to the universe had to be made by something, and then we regress back from the universe to a force outside the universe that made it, and we arrive, as the argument generally goes, at God. So say the philosophers, you can't reason this way, because you fall into the fallacy of infinite regression. The moment you get back to God, what is to stop you from saying, who made him? And then, who made God? And who made God? And regress. And where do you end up? Total frustration. All right, is there a quick answer for the argument of infinite regression? Yes, there is. You may care to make a note of it. The argument runs this way. When a person is talking to you and says, you can't argue me back to God, who made God? That's Bertrand Russell's great argument in his book, Why I Am Not a Christian. Incidentally, if you read the book carefully, you'll find out that Bertie is terrified of hell. He mentions it no less than 18 times in the book. And that's because his relatives were Christians and they brought him up to believe in Jesus Christ, and it never shook. He tried all his life to get away from him, he never got away. The last interview Bertrand Russell ever gave on television, he was asked the question, what would you like to be remembered for most? Your scientific and mathematical accomplishments, your philosophical accomplishments, or your humanitarian efforts? He said, I would like to be remembered, if at all, for the fact that I have tried to serve and to love my fellow man. The greatest of all maxims is thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. This is Bertrand Russell at 94. Spent his whole life trying to shake it, and he's back to it. And then the interrogator said to him, Dr. Russell, or Lord Russell, he said, we know that you're an atheist and that you don't believe in God. And Russell said, no, that's not true. He said, I am an agnostic. I do not know if God exists. I never said he didn't exist. I only said I didn't know. And then the fellow said to him, well, supposing you are wrong and he does exist, what would you claim as justification for your life? Russell sat in the chair, looked at the TV camera, and said, I suppose the fact that I have tried to fulfill the golden rule. So his justification at the end was what? He was going to be justified by the fact that he did listen to Jesus Christ. That to me is very significant about Bertrand Russell. Russell is the source of this criticism. Christianity cannot stand, and I won't be a Christian because I regress back to God and then beyond God who made him. So he gives up his faith. All right, now, how do you answer something like that quickly? Do it this way. Say to the person who gives you this argument, okay, let's assume that we have regressed from mankind through creation and the universe and we are now back at God. person says, all right, who made God? And you say, well, let's assume somebody did make him. Okay? All right. So what does it prove? It proves that we are not responsible to God's maker. We are responsible to ours. Think now. We are not responsible to God's maker. We are responsible to our maker. Why? Because if we appear before his throne and we give him the argument, I didn't believe in you because I can regress beyond you to somebody who made you, God could answer, it doesn't make any difference if somebody made me. The only thing that makes any difference is I made you.
Yeah.
Now I want to know what you did with what I told you to do. Very reminiscent of the hippies on trial in Chicago who were violently complaining to the judge that the judge had no authority to do anything to them. They were free moral agents. And the judge answered them by saying, I may not be the Supreme Court of the United States, but I do have enough authority to take care of you. 30 days. And he put him in. Now, there's a lesson to be learned from that. That judge was not the Supreme Court. That judge simply was an intermediary. But the intermediary had the power to judge those people. All right, let's use the philosophical argument that there is a finite God, that some force greater than God made him. The argument is totally irrelevant. The argument has no bearing and no weight the moment you grant it, because we are going to have to answer to the God that made our universe and that made us. And so the person who wants to regress beyond him has no reason to regress any further. Why? Because he's the one that's responsible for us, and he's the one that's going to demand of us why we didn't obey him. So give them their finite God, and then end right there with the finite God demands you to give an account to him. What are you going to say? You have cut the infinite regression argument right out. And you're at a God who has the power to send you to hell because you wouldn't believe in him. So then it leaves you in the nasty position of having to explain your relationship to him. And while they're mumbling around with that one, which is a difficult one to refute, it originated with Edgar Sheffield Brightman, the great philosopher at Boston University, who did believe in a finite God. But when he was pressed on the subject, he came up with a very nasty argument. The argument being, so what? It's exactly what it ends up at. God says, so what? Somebody made me, I made you. Buster, answer to me. That's the end of it. Where are you going to go from there? Anything beyond that is irrelevant. That's a reasonable argument. It's a rough translation of Brightman, who was a very very eloquent man. But we're doing pop apologetics, so it's a rough translation. Now, the people who talk about there really isn't any empirical or scientific evidence for the existence of God at all. Everything that exists only exists on the laws of statistical probabilities. Therefore, why in the world should we even think of the name God? Doesn't make any sense. I was going to appear one night on a television program, and I thought it'd be a good idea before I went if I talked to a truly good scientist, happens to be Earl U. Bell, who's top scientist in New York at that time for the Herald Tribune, before it went out of business, then he went to ABC. And U. Bell is a very gifted man. I went over to see him because I had some documents I wanted him to look at, and I wanted to ask him a question. We got over there, and I said, I've got to meet some people tonight on a program, and they don't believe in the existence of a created universe. He said, well, I said, well, I don't know what you believe, but I want to ask you a few questions. Go ahead. I said, what theory of the universe do you believe in? The Big Bang, that everything just boomed out of grandma and granddaddy hydrogen item, atom? He said, that has some merit. I said, what about the steady state theory? He said, I sort of lean to that the universe is expanding and contracting and exchanging energy and matter. He said, I lean towards that, Hoyle's theory. I said, how about the universe was created? He said, well, he said, that's unscientific. He said, we're talking outside the realm of science, that's metaphysics. I said, all right.
You've answered my question pretty well. I said, now I'm going to ask you another one. I said, there are only four possible logical... There are only four logical possibilities for the existence of the universe. He said, there are? I said, yes, there are. The first is that the universe emerged spontaneously out of nothing. And he just laughed. He said, well, it's ridiculous. He says, one of the basic laws of physics, from nothing, nothing comes. I said, right, you're right. I agree with you. Didn't happen that way. I said, the second is that the universe doesn't exist. It's an illusion in our minds, and we only think it's there. So he looked at me for a second. He said, are you for real? I said, I'm just asking. I said, that's a possible explanation. He says, it's ridiculous. He said, we can predict with pinpoint accuracy the movement of heavenly bodies. Look at Halley's Comet. We know it's going to come back unless it rammed into something. He said, it's going to come back 75 years after 1910. 1985, back we come. He said, we can tell eclipses, we can foretell this. He went into great detail. I said, all right, so predictability indicates that it's not illusory. Absolutely. I said, all right, the universe is not an illusion. I said, we know it's not an illusion. We know it didn't emerge spontaneously out of nothing. It must have always been there. So he looked at me for a moment, sort of fishy-eyed. He said, well, that depends. And I said, well, do you believe it was always there? He said, well, Hoyle's theory says it was always there. I said, do you believe it was always there? He said, well, I have some reservations about Hoyle's theory. I said, well, let me ask you a little further on the point. Because you have to dialogue this way. Because if you ever affirm anything with a scientist, he automatically takes the reverse position. You should always begin with interrogation, and then you're safe, because they don't know what you believe, so you won't have an argument right on the beginning of the discussion. And I said, let me ask you one more. I said, do you believe in the second law of thermodynamics? He said, yeah. I said, it holds that the universe is losing energy at a maximum rate so great that it can no longer be replenished, therefore, according to the Einsteinian theory of relativity, the end of the universe is maximum entropy, or absolute zero. You believe that? He said, well, Einstein did. I said, do you believe it? He said, well, the second law has been called into question. I said, has it been disproved? He said, no. I said, then the second law stands today. All the evidence is there. Yeah. The end of the universe is maximum entropy. I said, then it wasn't eternal. Because if it was eternal, it would be refiring itself at the same energy peak that it had when it was created, or when it was at its beginning. And it's not. So I said, there's only one other possibility, isn't there, Dr. Ubel? Something or someone outside this dimension of reality exercised a force infinitely greater than the universe at its maximum moment and brought it into existence. He said, that's metaphysics. I said, give me an alternative. I'm ready and willing. He said, well, there isn't a scientific alternative. I said, you either got eternal hydrogen atoms, or you have an eternal God. Which do you prefer? He said, well, a scientist can never affirm God. That's faith. I said, you exercise faith every moment of your life. All of us do. Why not faith in that process of thought, too? He said, well, anyhow, he said, when you go on the program, he said, I think what you're saying will hold up. He said, but find out what the man's scientific background is. So I went on the program, and I went through exactly the same steps that I went through with Dr. Ubel. And when I got to a crucial point on the program, one of the men who was on the panel said, and he slipped when he said it, he said, I believe that the universe came into existence. And I said, that's good. I believe that too. He said, but it came into existence not the way you and I think of something coming into existence. It just sort of happened. And I said, it just sort of happened? I said, from what? He said, well, I don't know. He said, it just
It's there. And I said, well, it's there, but how did it get there? He said, I don't know. He said, but the fact, now listen to this, the fact that it's there is proof that that's the way it had to happen. So help me. The fact that it's there, that's the way it's got to happen. I said, what a magnificent scientific explanation. What you are saying, in effect, is I don't know how the confounded thing got there, but however it got there, God didn't do it. He got very uptight.